The Lifestyle Show, presented by Selena McKenzie.
Now we're going to be talking about Hungary now, and this is for lovers of true crime. The village of Nagyrev was the scene of one of the deadliest poisoning epidemics of the 20th century. Well, in her new book called The Women Are Not Fine, journalist Hope Rees pieces together court documents, police records and more to find out what happened and why. She joins us now. Great to have you join us on the show, Hope.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Did I pronounce that right? Nagyrev?
It's actually Nagyrev. It's an extremely difficult Hungarian word, which I've been trying to master for the last several years and unsuccessfully.
Amazingly. I mean, if I pronounced it phonetically as it was spelt, I wouldn't have been able to do it. So I put it in the pronunciation in Google and it came out with Nagyrev, which is obviously completely wrong, so I apologize. So we're going back for this then. We're talking about the turn of the 20th century, so sort of the 1900s.
Around the early 1900s is when the midwife moved into Nagyrev. The first official poisoning didn't happen until 1911. But that's just what was on the paper, not what was actually going on there in the village.
So who was the midwife then?
So we have a small village in southeast Hungary. It's on the Tisza River. There is a midwife who came to the village. And at that time, the village, these small villages would have an official midwife. So there were more than one midwife there, but she was the official representative. She had a diploma. And when she was in the village, she was responsible not only for helping women give birth, but also taking care of general ailments. She was the de facto doctor at the time, since the doctor from Szolnok would only come in maybe one time a week.
Okay. I've got here that the story starts, again, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, but the story starts with midwife Zuzana Fazekas.
Yes, it's Zuzana Fazekas. Close.
Apologies. So was she part of these women? Did she know what was going on, which we'll obviously talk about very soon?
Right. So she came into this village and her role was as a ringleader. What she would do is listen to the women as they were giving birth, as they were also having abortions, which were illegal at the time. She helped with that. She was even involved sometimes in infanticide, which unfortunately was common at the time. There was no family planning. There was no way to prevent pregnancies. So she was involved in every intimate aspect of these women's lives. What she did was she offered them a solution. When they would share their problems with their husbands, they would tell her what was going on at home, the struggles they were enduring, the abuse they were enduring. She would say, "I have a solution for you." So the solution was arsenic. She would teach the women or sell it to them, but she would show them how to make this. It was, you just bought fly paper from the general store. You could boil it in a vat of vinegar or water, and you could distill this and drop it into a porridge, a palenka, which is a type of brandy, or a stew, anything. And so the deaths were slow. They were painful. Sometimes they happened in a couple of days. Sometimes they were drawn out over a course of weeks. Yeah. She was not the only woman to be helping other women with the poisoning. She was the one, however, who turned it into a business. She was pretty brazen. She smoked a cigar. She went to the pub. She had a kind of swagger. And she was definitely a woman who was unapologetic. So it was a very open secret at the time. So while there were other women doing this and passing along the method of poisoning among friends, she was the one who not only listened and offered the solution, but instigated a bit and really made this turn into something that happened at a small scale into a very like full-blown epidemic.
Right. A couple of things you said there. First of all, an open secret, but presumably only amongst the women.
Well, it actually was more open than that. Even the men knew about it. For instance, this midwife had a daughter who was a midwife herself. And as it happens, that daughter was married to the local coroner. So you can see how that's a kind of conflict of interest, because he was pronouncing the cause of death, yet he was afraid for his own life. And he was actually scared of his wife. He ended up leaving his marriage. But it was common. So the men knew it as well. There were men, stories of men who were afraid to go home, afraid to eat food at home, and worry what would happen. It was, over the course of 20 years, this went on. So very much passed along from friends to neighbors. The homes were right next to each other. You could see across the fence and know what was happening in your neighbor's yard. And so, yes, it not only among the women, but very much among the whole community.
Crikey. Well, the only thing the men had to do is stop being abusive, and then they didn't need to worry.
Right. So that's one of the solutions. Unfortunately, it wasn't only abusive men who were, ended up being killed. This actually did spiral. And by the end of it, there were older in-laws who were being killed. There were children. It was not exclusively husbands. It definitely started out as that, but spiraled into something different. It became so common at the time that the women accepted it as a kind of normal course of life. They would use language like, "We put him to sleep. We helped him with his suffering." So sometimes they did this to men who had returned from the war, who were injured, who were traumatized. Just want to make sure it's clear. Yeah, it is not exclusively abusive husbands, although that was definitely a common theme that I found.
And you mentioned children. Would they be sort of mercy killings? Would it be children that were poorly?
So it was mostly very young infants, not children, but it did happen that it was mainly, honestly, in order to survive. So if a family had too many children, it is possible that one of the infants would be killed.
Yeah, because abortion was illegal. I see what you're saying. And something else that you said is you said that this midwife started to make it into a business. So she made money out of it. It wasn't just that she was being kind and helping these ladies.
Right. She didn't charge too much money. So it does suggest that she had an interest in what was going on for the women. And money wasn't the primary objective, but she would charge. She would charge for the charge of, a sack of flour, food items. Sometimes there was bartering going on. It wasn't always directly money involved, but she would charge on a sliding scale. So she really did take into account how much the women were actually able to afford. So, she did care about them as well.
So were the women putting the arsenic in their food?
Yes. So like I said, porridge or stew or sometimes palinka, which is the Hungarian brandy. This was also a wine region. So there was a lot of drinking there. A lot of the homes had vineyards. And so men were frequently drinking, so that was a pretty common place to put it in their drink.
And they dissolved flypaper, is that to mix with the arsenic?
The arsenic came from the flypaper. So at that time, sorry if that wasn't clear, it was a kind of toxic flypaper, which in 1927 was finally banned because of suspected connection to the poisonings. So they discovered that this fly paper could be distilled in the boiling water, and that's how it came. Yeah.
Okay. And who is Auntie Susie?
Yes, that's who you just said, Zhuzhanna Fazekas. That is the main midwife.
That's what they called her. I've got you.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. So you say it happened over the next 20 years. So this quiet village suddenly became the epicenter of one of the most deadliest poisonings epidemics of the 20th century. How did they get away with it for so long?
Right. It's a fascinating question because, like I said, it was an open secret. So they knew what was going on in their neighbor's household. They knew what was going on with their friends. They were afraid. And there were some cases where people did start writing letters to the police, letters to the editor. Those would go to the nearby town of Szolnok, which was a bit of a bigger place at that time, 40 kilometers from Nijmegen. So the reason it really could last for so long was, one, like I said, there was no doctor in the village. So the deaths, although people did know that they were poisoning, could go under the radar because the doctor might not show up several days after the death. They could actually time it so that he wouldn't see, you know, the bodies until a bit later. Also, like I said, the coroner was married to the midwife's daughter, who is a midwife and a poisoner herself. So there wasn't anybody officially who could accuse the women. Also, like I said, these letters going to the authorities were anonymous. So while there was evidence, it was hard to actually pinpoint it. It didn't happen until there was so much evidence that was they were seeing multiple accusations that confirmed each other. And then finally they took action and issued a full-scale investigation, which involved exhuming the graves in the village of Nijmegen.
Oh, wow.
yes, exactly. And so this really turned the town upside down, as you can imagine. There were children around. Everybody was kind of peeking in to see what was going on. And in the end, they dug the graves up. They shipped them to Budapest to test for arsenic. And they found traces in nearly all of them.
Crikey.
So, yeah.
What happened to the women then? Were they able to? I mean, did they know which women had done it?
So they started this investigation that was a pretty intense and pretty thorough sweep of the town. They by any means necessary. So this wasn't a sit down and interview you type of process. It was catching people, rounding them up, hiding. In one case, there was a police chief hiding under a bed and having a couple of women in there and then springing out from under the bed and grabbing someone's ankle, waiting for them to, you know, reveal the secret. So, they were being cornered with their friends. So, these women were often, like I said, poisoning in groups. It wasn't only a midwife, but there was a whole big connection network of women. So they were rounded up, and in dozens of women in Nijmegen were arrested in the summer of 1929. There was a temporary prison in Nijmegen, and they held the women there. Kept them in jail for a few months until the first trial in 1929 in December. They would try the women together. At the very first trial, there were four women who were somewhat linked to each other. They were all on the stand that day, but the trials went on for a couple of years. So it was a very long process to eventually try everyone. There were 28 women in total who took the stand.
And did they all go to prison?
They did not. And I don't want to spoil the book, but
you'd have to read the book to find it.
There is a range of outcomes for the women. Three of them were actually ended up executed. So the sentences changed. It was actually almost double that. And it later changed. But there were women who were put in jail for life. There were women who were put in jail for 10 years, 5 years. And some of them were also let go because of the circumstances or because of a lack of evidence. While they could find arsenic traces in the body, it was hard to also, completely pinpoint the women, especially for murders that may have happened a decade prior to that. So we're talking years had gone by.
Yeah, of course. And I guess back then they weren't as sophisticated as we are now.
You're right. Yep. Yeah. And there was no, there were no diaries. There was no other evidence of this other than rumors and gossip in the town.
And as far as your research is concerned, Hope, we mentioned in the introduction that you went through court documents and police records. Was it easy to get all the information you needed for the book?
Oh, it was definitely not easy. And I worked very closely with a Hungarian researcher, a PhD student in history. For the last few years, he's been helping me figure out where exactly the right documents are located, how to find the information I need. And then once I found it, helping me translate sections of it. So as you can imagine, everything's in Hungarian. Not only that, not everything is digitized. So we had to physically, visit the archives, take photos of the papers, look through old letters. And we did also rely heavily on a couple of academic texts that have looked at the book so far. So it's been a long process to try to figure it out. And the other issue with it is that there are conflicting accounts. So there are even different versions of how many graves were exhumed or how many, the numbers were a bit hard to get at.
Yes, I'm sure. I'm sure it was all worth it. It sounds like a great read. And I know that you are a journalist, but is this your first book?
It is my first book. I've been a journalist for the last 15 years or so as a freelancer. This is it.
Congratulations. Well, the book is called The Women Are Not Fine, The Dark History of a Poisonous Sisterhood. It's by Hope Rees, who we're chatting to now, and we're selling it right now. We're actually not, we're pre-selling it. It looks like it's out the 10th of July. Is that right?
Yes, it is out on Thursday, though a few select bookstores have it available here in London. I was just at the British Library bookshop, and there's a few copies there. I will be in Malton tonight signing books and in Bristol on Wednesday. So, it's around.
Well, well done. And if people want to find out more about you, do you have your own website?
Oh, I do. Yep. Hope Rees, reese.com. That has information about the book, events, and everything else.
Well, the moral of the story is don't push your women to the brink.
Exactly.
It can be dangerous. Hope, it's been great chatting to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Take care. Good luck with the book signings. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.